This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've probably heard by now about Bob Woodward's new book, State of Denial, his third book about the Bush administration at war. This one, as the title implies, is about conflicts within the administration about what to do in Iraq, and about intelligence reports that have been kept secret from the public that tell a much more grim and pessimistic story than what the president has told us. Woodward concludes his book by saying, with all Bush's upbeat talk and optimism, he had not told the American public the truth about what Iraq had become. Woodward interviewed President Bush four times between 2001 and 2003. The president declined to be interviewed for the new book. Nearly all of the information in the new book, Woodward says, comes from interviews with the president's national security team, their deputies, and other senior and key players in the administration responsible for the military, the diplomacy, and the intelligence on the Iraq war. I spoke with Woodward about State of Denial and the process of writing it. You write in the 2004 presidential campaign the real evidence of just how badly things were going in Iraq. The data and trends on the violence, the number and the effectiveness of the enemy-initiated attacks, all this was kept classified, hidden away from the voting public. Are you saying that you think the information was kept classified for campaign reasons as opposed to national security reasons?
That's a profound question. It's part political and it's part, you know, if we advertise that we're getting that there's this level of violence, it may encourage the insurgency more and so forth. But I was quite frankly surprised to see the level of violence and that they did keep it classified. And that doesn't mean, you know, there were lots of reports, probably some of the best ones in my own newspaper, the Washington Post, about the level of violence, but they were always focused or almost always focused on specific attacks. But it turned out there was an attack every hour in Iraq. I mean, think of that, an attack every hour. That's 24-30 a day. It got to the point this year that there were attacks every 15 minutes. We haven't had one terrorist attack in this country that's been carried off in the last 5 years. To think of something where it's happening every 15 minutes or even one a day, let alone one an hour. This was never made clear and never stated, and it's one of the theme lines in the book, and that's why in part the book is called State of Denial, because they are denying this reality on the ground.
Well, you know, even in your first book about the Bush administration, you write about how, you know, President Bush doesn't really like doubt. And also in the first
book...
Yes,
I'm glad you picked up on that, because people think, oh, the first book I did on Bush has got all of this praise and it does have some of that and it shows very forceful action, but there are scenes in which Condi Rice comes to him. This is after 9/11 and they have started the war in Afghanistan, and says, well, maybe we should consider alternative strategies. And he totally rejects it, meets with his war council, and does not open the door again. He goes around the table and says, look, all of you guys signed up for this. Let's be patient.
Okay, he has an aversion to doubt. And in the first book, you also say that the president would not stand public discord. And I assume
yes.
You mean discord within the administration.
Yeah, didn't like hand-wringing, does not. I mean, he told me for that book, because I asked about it. He said the president has to be the calcium in the backbone, and said, quite frankly, I went down, spent hours with him at his ranch in Crawford in the summer, in August of 2002, and he said if he, as president, starts expressing doubt, it will just have a ripple effect in the whole national security team, so he has to remain firm. That's one of his beliefs. Now, in the first phase of the Afghanistan war, I think you can look back on it and say he was right, because that was just a period of weeks or months after the war began. But we are now 3.5 years into this war, where most of the news, unfortunately, is bad.
Well, you know, reading your book and seeing how members of the Bush administration publicly misrepresented the classified reports that they were getting about how badly things were going in Iraq. I kept wondering, has President Bush believed the misrepresentations, or has he not fully understood the discord between the intelligence reports and some of the public statements that he and other members of his administration have made about Iraq?
That's exactly the right question, and that's exactly why I asked to interview President Bush, and he declined, his advisors declined, and so I do not know the answer to that. I suspect, I don't want to ascribe motives, but I had lots of questions of his senior advisors and other cabinet members along these lines, and I have to be direct with you. I think that's why I didn't want to talk, because I didn't want to answer questions on this, because the discrepancy, it's not just one or two times, it's dozens of times over 3.5 years.
Now, one of the controversies about your approach now to writing about the Bush administration is that you're gathering all this information for books, and you withhold the information until the book is published. And so the question has been raised, is this the way to deal with inside information about intelligence and the Bush administration and the war in Iraq? Would the American public be better if every time you had a revelation, you published it in a daily newspaper, such as the Washington Post, which you've written for years, instead of waiting months or years to publish it in a book? So what do you say to that?
The problem is you can't just it's not as if there's one revelation. And what you want to do is, this is an interagency government. If you find out something about the Pentagon, you want to see what the CIA angle is on it. What's the White House NSC staff angle on it? So you go back to people and you develop sources and you try to present a full picture. And I think the full picture is the most important thing.
You know what I'm wondering? Like with Watergate, you didn't wait. With Watergate, it was like every time there was new information, it was published. Now, of course, you didn't have a track record as an author yet. It was early in your career. But you found a way with Watergate to publish information as you got it.
Yes, that's right. And I had a colleague working with me, Carl Bernstein, who was probably one of the best reporters in America. I was very young, had no family, and I think as the book we wrote on this demonstrates, you work full-time, day and night, weekends. You have to be a creature of the night. I'm 63 years old and have a family, and I try to work hard, but to get in that mode, which quite frankly I did after 9/11, I have discussed this with the editors of the Post, with Don Graham, who is the CEO of the Post Company. And if I found something that was so critical I would publish it in the newspaper. I think all of this is critical, but it all fits together.
You write that when you interviewed Rumsfeld, you submitted 29 sample questions in advance. And I guess I was surprised to read that you were submitting advanced questions. Do you usually do that? I think because the assumption is if you submit questions in advance, particularly to people in the political world, that they will come up with more expert ways of spinning the answer or evading the question.
Well, it turned out that I had so much information. I mean, Rumsfeld gets to say what he wants to say, but you want some. These are busy people. You want them to know what you want to focus in on and ask. Quite frankly, you want them to prepare. In no way do you say these are the only questions I'm going to ask, and there is no limit on the questions or the issues or how you're going to conduct the interview. But quite frankly, in the case of Rumsfeld, I submitted those questions, and you're right, there were 29 of them. And Rumsfeld looked at that. Now, remember, he's given no interviews for books or anything at length about post-war Iraq. He saw those questions, and I believe, and aides told me, realized I had all kinds of information, classified, inside, what he had done, what he had said. And it is those questions, I think, that caused him to say, well, A, this guy is serious. This guy has got lots of information. I'm going to sit down and respond. In this case, it worked, and there is an abundance of information I got. The whole business of the mission accomplished speech that the president gave on the aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, May 1st, 2003, Rumsfeld disclosed and said just openly when he saw the president's speech, it had mission accomplished in it. And he said, I almost died. I got it out of the speech, but not didn't get the sign down. Now, the White House has always taken the position that the mission accomplished sign was put up by the Navy and the military, and they were not responsible. Here's Rumsfeld saying it was in the speech, clearly. The White House had some had total responsibility for the speech. So, so many things are learned in this process. I think the value of submitting questions in advance, it works.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is there's a little more first person in here than in your previous books. And you,
yes.
You basically express your astonishment at one point that it takes President Bush about 5 minutes in an earlier interview you did with him, to admit that we haven't found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You express astonishment at an analogy that Donald Rumsfeld uses in an interview comparing problems in Iraq with the mixed fruit in a fruit bowl.
Not just the problems, but the attacks that are killing and wounding our soldiers. He says they're like it's like a fruit bowl, apples, oranges, bananas.
Why is there more of you? Why do you allow yourself to express astonishment at what your sources within the administration are telling you in a way that you didn't allow yourself to do that in previous books?
That's a really good question. And I served in the military, in the Navy in the 60s in Vietnam. And I did not like the Vietnam War. I didn't know what to do about it, but I was stuck out on a ship or ordered around because people at the higher levels had decided on a certain policy, which I did not understand, that in fact was not explained to me. In fact, at the time, I thought was wrong and opposed. Quite frankly, I identify with the 147,000 American troops we have stuck in Iraq. I'd be honest with you. I think about them regularly, and I put myself in their shoes. And I know what they're thinking. We've reported magnificently on this in the Washington Post, frankly, by going out and interviewing sergeants and privates and officers who say, we don't quite know why we're here. One actually said, in one story we published on the front page, that we're here waiting to be blown up. And so I know what it's like to have. I remember when I served in the Navy, I was extended for a year, fifth year. And at the time I said to people, this is like a one-year Gulf of Tonkin resolution on another year of my life. And those people are stuck. They're the ones who bear the burden of this. And I feel very strongly, I'm sorry, I guess I can't bleach out my own emotions on this, that we need to explain why we're there. We need to know why we're there. We need to be truthful about what's going on. And when the Secretary of Defense, as he did in that interview with me, compares the things that are killing people to bananas, apples, and oranges, I'm speechless, as I report in the book. When the Secretary of Defense denies that he's a military commander, I quoted McNamara, the former Secretary of Defense, saying, as he does in that wonderful documentary, The Fog of War, if any military commander is honest with you, he will tell you that he's made mistakes that have cost lives. And I quoted this to Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld said, well, yes, military commanders, and said he's not. Now, here's the number two person right after the president. And I said, no, you are by law. And I literally said the president and Secretary of Defense to the combatant commander. And he said, well, maybe by indirection or two or three steps removed. He is a military commander. He can't take himself out of the chain of command, but he did. He said it. And I express astonishment at that. I guess that is not the voice of a reporter. That is the voice of a young lieutenant in the Navy stuck in Vietnam.
I want to go back to another story that you're involved with, and that is the leak of the fact that Ambassador Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame Wilson, was a CIA agent. It turns out you were the first reporter to hear that she was a CIA agent, and you...
No, actually, I was told that she was a WMD analyst.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Significant difference. That's why I didn't one of the reasons why I didn't think it was a big deal.
When you were told you didn't think it was a big deal?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you heard it from Richard Armitage.
He has said that. That's correct.
Well, knowing what you know and having been involved in the way... You know, in the way or the tangential way that you were, do you think that there is still the possibility that members of the Bush administration leaked the information that she was a CIA agent, you know, an undercover CIA agent, to discredit her?
I don't know. I mean, it's
or,
pretty clear.
I should
clear
say to discredit her husband is what I mean to say.
That's the right way to phrase it. I don't know. The prosecutor has told Armitage and other people like Karl Rove that he's not going to charge them. Scooter Libby has been indicted for perjury. I think, and it may have been on your show, where I said that this investigation is laughable or is going to come to laughable results. I think that was definitely the wrong choice of words. Any investigation like that is serious. Though I was not involved in the story or the case, I had not been called. I should have thought ahead to the 10th bounce and realized it was possible I would and shouldn't have said anything about it. But I knew something about it, and I was trying to give people a clue. I don't think this is going anywhere, and as we now know, other than the indictment of Libby, it hasn't gone anywhere.
One final question. Throughout the book, you reprint haiku that was written by Colonel Steve Rotkopf, and I just want to read a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, "Where is WMD? What a kick if he has none. Sorry about that." And another one, "Mental bone tired, hard to stay, not wanted, can't rest, men will die." These are really kind of interesting haiku, and I wonder why you decided to print them through different parts of the story in the book.
Well, my assistant Bill Murphy did the interviews on this, and the colonel was the deputy intelligence chief tasked with finding WMD, and it's a real-time expression, and I guess this goes back to the emotions of the people on the ground, and I think I included it because it is contemporaneous reaction by somebody in a very senior and sensitive position, expressing his emotions about doubt and about the difficulty and about the bone tiredness of war.
Bob Woodward, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bob Woodward's new book is called State of Denial.